This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Okay, this is Clint Locklear from Trapping Across America, and I'm still in Mississippi, and I'm with a very interesting character right now that we have to get to the bottom of something first. Now, you went hunting with us this morning, so you're not an anti.
That's exactly right.
And you're not a liberal.
I'm not.
And what is it you claim to be?
I am a semi-intelligent redneck.
Okay. And see, I was told that you're a patent attorney.
I am.
And that's like with a real degree. It didn't come from you stayed at the Holiday Inn Express.
The paper is on the wall. It's a real degree with a lot of sweat equity involved.
Okay, and are you sure about that?
Yes.
Because I guarantee someone's going to hear this and try to figure out some way that we're going to be messing with it.
I am a patent attorney. Yes, I am.
Okay. Do we need to have a disclaimer where you're not giving legal advice, you're not trying to administer drugs to make somebody cure a disease, anything like that?
I don't have anything for anybody to sue me for, so they can't get blood out of a turnip. So if they sue me over anything I say in this, then that's they're barking up a coonless tree. There's nothing there.
Okay, so I kind of think you are a patent attorney, so why don't you go and introduce yourself and where you're from.
I'm Timothy Smith. I'm a Mississippi boy. I live in Jackson, Mississippi now. My background was science and somehow ended up in law school and thinking I wanted to do environmental law, and then I took a class in that and realized that I didn't want to have to deal with the EPA for the rest of my life, and ended up working at a place called Pennington Biomedical Research Facility in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, while in law school, and worked with some patent attorneys. And you have to have a science or technical background before you can sit for the patent bar. At least that used to be the case. I assume it still is. And so I studied real hard and sat for the patent bar and was blessed enough to pass it, and became a patent agent, and then graduated law school shortly thereafter, and thought about staying in the Louisiana area because there's more of a market, quite frankly, for patent lawyers. But being a Mississippi guy and being married to a Mississippi girl and all of our family being here, moved back to Mississippi. And that was 13 years ago. Worked in the private sector for a while. Work in the government sector now. Quit filing patent applications about 4 or 5 years ago, for the most part. One, because it, with children and the like, and working a regular job, it just got to be too much of a burden and too much of a stressor. But still keep my thumb on the pulse of it a little bit and in that world, and it fascinates me, and enjoy helping people along the way and steering people through the landmines if I can.
So from what I just gathered from what you said, you actually have real world experience with this.
Yes.
You just didn't graduate college yesterday or take the bar, so you're giving practical
real world advice that's been learned through the school of hard knocks and experience as much as anything else. So worked with inventors from really sophisticated PhD types down to generic country boys, and that I frankly prefer to work with, talking earlier off of the audio that it seems to be a common characteristic. I think that there's maybe there are some studies out there about entrepreneurs and about people that are inventive and creative also tend to have an artistic nature to them as well. And so I've been around dozens and dozens and dozens of entrepreneurial inventors, and they all seem to have that common characteristic, and most seem to have a drive, and most seem to have, and I think it's what drives it. Some seem to have, if not most seem to have, maybe have a little bit of dreamer about them, and maybe expect a little more out of a patent in particular than is there to be derived. And so that's when I talk about steering people through the landmines and around them, that's mainly what I'm talking about. Everybody has an invention and everybody thinks it's going to make them a millionaire, and people have watched Shark Tank and they've watched or they've read or whatever, and it's not what it appears. And so just like whatever your profession is, you probably assume that, or people may make assumptions about what you do for a living that you may have made too before you started doing it, and once you get in it you realize that things are not always what they appear, and intellectual property certainly that way as well.
Since you went down that road, I want you to say your quote before I start getting into the actual interview.
A patent is not worth the paper it's printed on unless you can afford to defend it.
And well, so, not that one. You're getting ahead. About the chess.
Oh, well, let me make sure that I quote myself right. This is a quote that I cannot claim to be my own, but which I read this week, which is very, very good. It says, "Do your own thinking, be the chess player and not the chess piece."
That's pretty awesome.
It's a pretty sweet quote. I agree. I'm kind of adding that to my quotes to live by. My new quote, that's an old quote, is that there are hammers and nails in the world, and be the hammer. It's preferable to be the hammer. And so I'm adding that quote as well. You be the chess player, not the chess piece. And oftentimes, we all find ourselves being the chess piece. But I think that it's better to think our ways through things and
not just follow.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, it's kind of like whenever your wife comes home, there's always good news and bad news. Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and get the bad news kicking the nuts right out of the way.
Yeah.
And this just came up on her business course. I've got this idea. I think I want it to be patented, And then I kind of said what you did, because I've been around some things that's happened in the trapping industry. So, like you were saying, it's not worth the... I'm going to let you go into that. But I think before someone runs out and spends their money on... especially something like in the trapping industry, there needs to be a realistic value. You come up with something that's really hot in the trapping industry, it may realistically, in a net profit way, really big home run hit, $200,000. Mm-hmm. So that's the scale of market we're at. And most guys are in they make an extra $10,000-$15,000 a year off something.
Right.
So if they want to patent it, what should they know right off the bat?
Well, if they want to patent it, one, they need to understand that, like I said a second ago, it's not worth the paper it's printed on unless you can defend it. And people say, well, what does that mean? Patent litigation, which means a patent infringement suit. You have a patent, you're real proud of it, you're making a little bit of money off of this idea. A patent, as some know, maybe not most, is the government gives you a mini monopoly, basically. You have the exclusive right to make, use, or sell this widget that you've invented. This is a good thing, and then the idea behind a patent, and I don't want to discourage people away from getting a patent per se, but you need to take a business approach to it. It is a legal instrument, but it is something that necessitates a business mind and a business approach, and you very much need to run cost to benefit analysis. And so if you find yourself a reputable patent attorney, the first thing he's going to want to do or demand to do is to have a very in-depth prior art search performed. If you run into a patent attorney that does not want to do that,
trapper talk. So when you do these definitions,
so a prior art search is anything. You cannot get a patent on an item if it's in the public domain. That means another patent on this given item, or it can mean something that was known to be used, 150 years ago. You're in, the Yukon, and you find this item that's hanging on a shelf of a abandoned cabin, and you think, man, that's a great idea. I'm gonna use this thing and go get a patent on it. Well, technically speaking, you shouldn't be able to do that. As a matter of fact, people make this mistake. If you have a great idea and you disclose it in public, if you write a letter about it, or you send an email of it, or you disclose it at a trade show, you technically have started a one-year window that is closing by the day for which you can even file a patent application. And so to make sure that you're not spinning your wheels in vain, it is very, very important that you have somebody that is willing to go the extra mile, whether it means paying somebody in DC to actually go search the trademark office files or somebody that can do it in-house. And we have Google patents, and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has their own search engine for ideas as well. You need to make sure that there is nothing else out there that the Trademark Office, Patent and Trademark Office, can use to reject your patent application. They have to justify their existence, so they'll probably initially reject it based on some prior art that's out there that they think may look like what you have or sound like what you have or what have you. But like I said, they have to justify their existence. But you want to make sure, if at all possible, that you're not filing something that's already out there.
Now, but just because this is what I hear this all the time in trapping, and people believe this like they believe their mother's their mother because their mother told them that they're their mother. Well, he's got a patent. I just need to change it a little bit, and they can't mess with it.
Can't really do that. They're in the U.S., international patents are a little different, but in the U.S., there is a little bit of a hedge of protection around a person's patent. There is a little bit of there's some wiggle room there. And so if there is it's really more of a trademark and trademark type of standard, and I won't get down into the legal weeds of it too much, but if there is a substantial likelihood of confusion among a reasonable person that would have knowledge or be skilled in trapping, then chances are you won't be able to make a slight change and get a patent on it. Moreover, sometimes what you see in a patent is not all that's actually patented. The patent is comprised of a specification and drawings, and it also has the claims. The claims in a patent are similar to the meets and bounds of a property deed. And you have different types of claims.
Lawyer,
yes, and so it is. There you go. So I proved myself. And so it is a weird way that has some historical significance, but a weird way to describe what the invention is. And you have independent claims, which are larger and describe the invention as a whole, and then you have dependent claims, which relate back to the independent claim, and those get down into the weeds a little bit more. Maybe what if it's a trapping device, maybe what the components are made out of. If they're made out of steel, if they're made out of aluminum, if they're made out of some alloy or what have you. And so little derivatives, and so little bitty changes. They can be structural as well, not just components and things like that. And so that's another thing, is if you're trying to make something, invent a better widget that has a patent on it, you need to have a patent attorney, frankly, look at the patent that you're trying to get around. I mean, that happens every day, and let them give you some guidance on things that would actually give you some separation there. A patent has to be non-obvious. It has to be new. It has to have some sort of utility purpose if it's a utility patent. And so So the first thing is to have a very quality search done, and that's going to cost you some money, frankly. Probably you're looking at, depending on where you are geographically in the country, you're looking at probably $1,000 or more. To have a patent application filed and the first office action responded to, you're probably looking at an additional $10,000 to $20,000. If it's rejected and you want to keep pushing and file an appeal, you may be looking at another $10,000. And so you
can. So we're at $31,000.
Yeah. So you literally could get $20,000 to $30,000into having this thing just patented, and that just means that it's protected. And so say you spend, let's give you a big discount and say you spend $10,000 and you get a patent, and it's probably a year and a half process to get that at a minimum. Say you get it though, and then you go to a trade show and you see a guy and he has basically copied exactly what you've got.
Or he did the magical one or two little
things. Yes, he changed a few little things, and you're going to confront him about it, and he's going to say, well, no, it's not the same because I did these two little things. And you're going to say, nope, that's my idea. It's covered in my patent. You got to stop. And the guy's going to say, well, I don't know. I disagree with you. And so then what do? Well, you hire an attorney, and you send a cease and desist, and that's probably going to be another couple hundred bucks. And then the guy's
going to... Which is just a nasty letter
saying that's right, a nasty letter that says, this is protected under patent number such and such. If you continue, we're going to sue you, and we're going to seek an injunction against your use of the item. We're going to sue you for damages. We're going to sue you for attorney's fees. And then you don't hear anything back from him, or his attorney sends you a letter back that says, we're not infringing on your patent, and, you know, you see how the slippery slope goes.
Mm-hmm.
So... then you've got to make a decision. Am I making enough money to justify paying a patent litigator $300 to $500 an hour to file a lawsuit against this joker?
Can I ask you one question before you change your thought? Because I just thought, is there any way binding with two parties have that say in the trapping industry mm-hmm. where they can go to arbitration without spending all that money?
They can. You can seek arbitration. You can seek mediation. That can happen, and most,
but not if they're being buttholes to each other.
No, it rarely occurs. Sometimes a judge will order it. Sometimes a judge will say, you know what, I'm tired of dealing with you guys. You're going to go to mediation. You're going to try and work this out. And he's going to put it off on a certified mediator to try and get you to figure it out. And that happens in all manner of litigation. So getting kind of back on point in the litigation aspect of it, you're looking at in really complex patent litigation, which is, you know, things in the computer world. It's not unheard of to have $1 million in legal fees in a rather generic utility patent, say a trapping device. It is not unusual to have a couple $100,000 at a minimum in legal fees. And then at the end of the day, even if you win, you may not make that much money. Say you get damages for the business that he took away from you, where you're going to have to pay an expert to show what that monetary figure is. And if you're making,
say if it is a home run, $200,000.
Yeah, if you're making $200,000, well, that eats a lot into your margin right there. And then you got to pay your attorney, and you hope to get attorney's fees. In a lot of cases, unless it's an egregious violation of a patent, you're not going to be eligible for attorney's fees. And so you're going to have to pay those out of your own pocket too. And so that's what I get back to saying. It's not worth the paper that it's printed on unless you can afford to defend it. So now everybody's probably sitting there thinking, well, why in the world would I ever file a patent? Well, they can be worth it. And they can be worth it in building out a business. They add value to a business. And certainly, if you want to do this to eventually sell it, having a patent, if you're going to sell to a larger company, a larger outdoors company, or what have you, then it definitely can be worth it. And so, like I said, going back, kind of circling back around, it is a cost to benefit analysis that you have to do, which is a business analysis. It's not a legal analysis. It's a business analysis. With that being said, there are other ways to skin the cat. We talked about that earlier. There are ways that I have found that maybe you don't have to have a patent, and maybe you get as much benefit from another form of intellectual property in the grand scheme of things, and that is to come up with a catchy name for your company, get a trademark on that name, build your idea, your invention around that name, and get market share. Have that market share associated with your product. Will people be able to copy your product? Yes. But the hope is that people will go to you because that's where they heard about it first. And so, and that happens a lot. I won't name the name of the business, but some of you guys will know it. There is a very, very prominent hunting clothing manufacturer that had a patent application on their technology denied years ago. They were smart about their business model, and not only did they seek a patent on their idea, they also trademarked their name and logo, and they spent a hefty amount of money in marketing. And even though their patent was denied, their market share really has not diminished at all, maybe even increased, because they were known to have a quality product that worked, and their name is associated with that product. And the same can be true in the trapping world. You have a catchy name associated with your product, and you get it out there, and you're clever and slick about your marketing, and you work with the right people to get this out there, and use word of mouth, and use social media, and use other mechanisms that we have at our disposal now to have this product's name and name association wound so tightly together that even if somebody does copy your idea, you're not sweating it too much because your market share is established. And so, of course, then you kind of get into price point and things like that, and you may have to move and shake a little bit if a guy's trying to undercut you, but that's all part of business decisions too. And to file for a trademark is something that you don't need an attorney to do. You can file online. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office website is actually really good for that. It walks you through the process. It's about a $400 filing fee. You need a JPEG image of the file, and you need some images of your mark in use. So just digital camera photos of brochures or t-shirts or a booth at a trade show or whatever. You have a trademark. If you formed a company, an LLC or an S-Corp, the S-Corp LLC can own that intellectual property, so you've automatically built value into your company if you were to sell it. And you don't have $20,000 in patent legal fees for something that's about a 50-50 chance of you even getting once you file it. And can you have legal fees relative to trademark infringement? Sure, you can, but they're typically not anywhere near the gravity from a monetary standpoint. They're not as complex, and normally it's kind of, I mean, it's something that's settled before you even get to court. I mean, you've got a name of a product that you've come up with, that you've been given a trademark on, and somebody copies that name, it's kind of obvious at that point who the infringer is, and courts aren't real friendly with that. Patents can get a little more complicated and expert intensive, and so that there's your issues. So there are other ways, particularly for the common man like us, to get into the intellectual property world and actively and tacitly protect an idea or an invention, and not necessarily have to have a patent on it.
So, I mean, going back, this for to put this in money sense, in my brain, from what you were saying, an average thing to defend against is probably going to be, with the cost of the patent, the cost of litigation, plus the filing fees and all that type of stuff, we're about, say, $230,000.
Yeah, it could be there. It could be less. You could find an attorney that can get you a patent for $10,000. Probably.
Okay. So, even at $200,000.
Yeah,
so,
$200. But when you get into the litigation, yeah, absolutely.
So when a business is making something, let's say it's crazy amount of profit. You know, this is what I don't think guys that I've talked to understood. Well, I'm making that so I can pay that. Mm-hmm. Well, gross and net, when you break those two apart, most guys I've seen get into this, it's like they've spent 4 years of their production income after they pay taxes and expenses and everything. Just to be at the base start when they started.
That's right.
And what you said, I love what you said.
Yeah.
Especially in a niche market. Like, to me, patents are more for big commodity.
They are.
It's going to be sold in millions of
pharmaceuticals. You know, I mentioned Pennington Biomedical. You know, they used to, I don't know if they still do, but they phase trial studies for pharmaceutical companies to get things through the FDA. And you're looking at billions in investment and billions in profit. And so spending a million or two on a, mm-hmm. a lawsuit's not that big of a deal for those guys. You know, IT patents in the Microsoft and Apple world, you know, millions if not billions of dollars, but they're cool with it because they're making millions mm-hmm. and billions of dollars. And so in a way, some of the different large market companies have outpaced and stretched what a patent was when they came into existence with the U.S. government. And so it's not an apples to apples comparison when you're comparing a small time guy. And you could be a small time guy and be a millionaire, but it's still going to eat into your money. Mm-hmm. We're talking people that are hundreds of millionaires, companies, billionaires, and billion-dollar companies that have massive revenue streams. And so it's not really hurting them that much because they have that much capital to expend. I've seen patent suits where people know that the person's not infringing, but they're trying to drain financially their competition.
Mm-hmm.
And see the little guy get squeezed. And that's something that, you know, and going back to our analogy, you run into the guy at the trade show and he's copying your idea. Well, he might be more financially stable than you, and he might fight you just to fight you, just to run you out of the market because he knows you're not sustainable in the long run. And so, and eventually try and buy your patent from you. I've seen that for pennies on the dollar, you know. And so there's frankly some evil folks in the world, and they'll go after a guy that's good and has put his life's work into something just because they can. So,
well, I mean, I can think of two friends of mine that have fought the patent thing, and when it's all said and done, they were absolutely broke.
Yeah.
And they were absolutely beaten.
Yeah.
Even if they won, and the only thing they had when they were to go, see, I was right. And,
yeah.
You know, from a business point of, that's where, you know, you have to separate emotion in your business.
That's right.
If that comes up, you just go, that ain't worth it.
It's not. For most people, it's really not.
Because I know Chip's talked to you about some stuff we've talked about. And I'm like, I don't know, you know.
Yeah, sometimes it's just better to run with it and see what happens. And if it blows up, then that's well and good. You know, I have seen business models before where somebody did not get a patent but made good money on something and used the money that they made. Like I said, most people who are patent owners, that ain't their first rodeo with an invention, and it won't be their last rodeo with an invention. They're inventive, creative people by nature, and sometimes you use your first invention to generate enough money to springboard you into maybe getting a patent on your second invention, you know, when you're more financially stable. And so I think that's something that people run. We all have a tendency to fall in love with our inventive ideas, and there is a panic, I think, that is maybe inherent sometimes, that we think, well, this is it. I'm not going to ever think of anything that's going to top this, and I've got to protect it, and I'm going to throw my whole existence into protecting it. And you're kind of selling yourself short, because there might be a better widget in your mind that just hadn't come to the surface yet.
That you're not going to figure out because you spent all your energy.
That's right, and time and money. And so Chip and I had a conversation a while ago about, you know, the freedom to be able to think. And you can't put a monetary value on that. Sometimes it takes a little bit of money to buy yourself the freedom to think. And that could happen with the idea of getting market share on an item, not necessarily worrying about the patent on it, but trying to, you know, keep your wheels spinning and come up with something else. And maybe you're financially solvent enough to go for a patent on that one. Or you can build out your business, just like everybody. Most people start a business out very small and build it out. And you know, Walmart started small and it built out. Mm-hmm. And the same can be true in this as well. And you might branch out from trapping to something that's larger. I mean, the outdoors industry, the hunting industry, is a billion-dollar industry, and there's room for money to be made. I guess what I'm saying, I don't want to discourage anybody from going and researching and trying to get a patent. I'm just telling you to be leery that there are not necessarily good business outcomes in that world. It's not a sure thing by any stretch of the imagination. And so you have to allow yourself room to think about things. I kind of, when I'm pondering large plans or large ideas in my own mind, I try to do my method is to saturate my mind with as much information as I can on the given topic, and then allow it to grow or incubate, which means time, And then at the end, hopefully you come out with a better product. It's amazing how your mind can change and new ideas pop in and out, and you can shuffle what's good and what's bad just by giving yourself one overload of data on the front end and then just sitting back and thinking about it. Just when you're in this world running your trap lines, allow your mind to shut off from what you're doing and think about what you want to do. And so, it's there, but you have to, you can't be overzealous. So,
well, the main reason I wanted you to do this is because, you know, I've given trapping instructions to guys that had to like sell their kids to get it because they want to be professional. And I gave a trapping instruction to somebody that's got their name on a football stadium, believe it or not.
Yeah.
So there's a wide range. But realistically, most trappers are middle class to lower middle class as a whole, you know, outdoorsmen. And, you know, when I hear people talk about the patent and they're all excited about the, a good idea and they're really excited about it, but to go spend that money depletes their lifestyle and their, and then once they get it, like you're saying, you can't defend it. So you've like wiped out your savings. You can't get mama a new kitchen when she wants one. There's nothing you can do if somebody bigger and badder comes
along. It is in this world, particularly kind of in the trapping world and the money that it generates as we sit here today. I think that it really should, if you're immediately, you think of an idea and a week later you got a patent attorney on the phone and you're setting up a meeting and you're drawing money out of your savings to put a retainer down, then you've probably outkicked your coverage a little bit. Ponder on it a little bit. There are a lot of resources available to us now that were not available even 10 years ago. Go to Google Patents. Go to the Google website, type in Google Patents.
Is that a Google platform?
It is a Google platform. It is a Google platform that accesses the government platform. And so it is an amazing application that most folks don't know about. And it is keyword search, just like Google. And you can, I promise you, you can reference and cross-reference yourself to death and trying to find something that's like what you got. And your intent when you're doing a patent search needs to be to try and find exactly what you have out there. And if you can't, then maybe you got a fighting chance. My advice when you're doing that, one of the requirements for a patent application is that you disclose other patents that you think are similar to your idea, believe it or not. It's kind of counterintuitive. But you've got to disclose to the patent office, this is kind of like my idea, but then you get to differentiate why it's not. One of the techniques that most patent attorneys use is they'll find, doing keyword search, they'll find patents that are similar, and then embedded within those patents, there'll be links to other patents that those guys cited. And you can reference and cross-reference, and you can, in a given area, you can really cover a lot of area. One of the cool things about a patent, a utility patent, is it requires drawings. And so for us that are visually more gifted than sitting there reading through minutia, it's pretty easy to see if something's like your idea or not. Give it a glance and then give it a second glance. Sometimes things don't look like our idea, but the actual inherent mechanism is the same. And that can be enough to bar you from getting a patent. So it doesn't necessarily have to look exactly like yours, but you think about mechanisms, think about utility when you're looking at these prior art searches, and save them, print them, and that way when you eventually do, if you don't find anything and you do go to a patent attorney, you can hand them a whole stack full of paper and they can begin their prior art search and have a little bit of a running start. And that might actually serve to save you some time and money if you do decide to go the patent route. So,
well, I mean, when you were saying that about people, I knew some guys that come up with a better way on something in an industry that was becoming real hot. Mm-hmm. And it really made the mechanism work so much better. Mm-hmm. They patented that. And mm-hmm. they got the patent. Well, all the big boys in that thing looked at these two guys and went, nah, they ain't got no money.
Right.
And they just started producing them like crazy.
That's right.
And that's when I've learned about the... By the time they made the injection molds for this thing and they're already in at 60, then they, you know, it was just like, you can't win.
You can't. Know? And
but you can win with marketing. That's
you can win with marketing and you can win with business maneuvering. And, marketing, we live in and I'm not a marketing person. My wife, actually, she has a degree in marketing. And I think that it is easier now, in my personal opinion, it is easier now to market to a broad spectrum of people from, location, geography now maybe than ever before for free with things like Facebook and things like Twitter and things like Instagram and YouTube and Google and all these different things. We can reach so many people with relatively no cost. And, you couple that with your logo and you make sure that logo and that name is associated with that product in every way possible. And all of a sudden you build a market share and people want the original. They want what the original thing is. You know, I mean, even to this day, Xerox copiers, they still hold a large market share and they make a quality product, but there are a lot of quality products out there, but people associate copying with Xerox. I mean, it's a generic term now because of that, to Xerox something. And so it is something
it's
that
funny you say. We just bought a new printer last week
and
I told Cindy going to Chattanooga, I'm like, this is not acting right. They're not expensive. Go and pick up one that we can hook wirelessly to the iPad now.
Right.
And she calls back, what kind do you want? I said, I don't know. It's as long as, I can print from the computer and Xerox stuff off.
Exactly. It's a generic term. And so that ought to be your goal in with your invention, is to make your trap name a generic term that happens to point right back to your company. And so that is, in my opinion, the most cost-effective way for most people to get into this world. And then once you have that, you have the ability, you may have some money flow, some cash flow, to build out and be more inventive and produce more products associated with this trademark name. That's the beauty of it, is you trademark your business name and you don't have to do it again. You can renew it and keep it going. And so it's not like you each invention you're going to have to file another patent application on. It's not the case with the trademark idea. You can stack all sorts of your ideas up under that one name. And so it's not the only way, but it is a way. So,
well, let me kind of complicate this a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. I've never brought this up before, and I was really, really shocked when this came to my attention. Somebody that is a salesman that deals with overseas, I probably got the biggest website network for trapping. So whenever you type in anything, you come across one of my websites.
Right.
Well, that put me on the radar of somebody from China.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm somewhere, and I agreed to meet this guy because I could not understand what in the world he was actually talking about. And there, out of his little boxes, he pulled out stuff that is absolutely 100% patented. And we're going to say, I'm not going to say the name because I don't want to get anybody looking for this, but Billy Bob's Wizardly Wonderful Awesomeness Trap. It's got the same stamp on the pan. It's got the same hardened bolts. If you put one to the other,
can't tell the difference.
You can't tell the difference. So even then, that made me even more leery of patent, because what am I going to do against a Chinaman?
That's right.
Across the ocean,
not a lot you can do. You can file to have an injunction against whatever company is importing this into the country, and even that gets kind of sketchy. But
because they can just change importers, can't they?
Yeah, they'll just change, and you're it's the mouse and cat game at that point. And so China is and will continue to be a burr under the saddle of anybody, any honest businessman or dishonest businessman that has intellectual property. I dealt with that a little bit, actually, in again at Pennington, and It is almost government-sanctioned piracy in a lot of ways. And so it's something. There are international patents and international patent applications, and you can go that route. You can actually do international trademarks as well. And so and that's something for you guys in the trapping world in North America. I mean, you can get a trademark in the U.S. and you can convert that and get one in Canada. And yeah, you can have protection in North America on those grounds. But that is another kind of detriment to the patent world is that that China is ready, willing, and able to infringe all over you. Well, and there are American businessmen who are quite ready to deal with them, too.
I could not believe it. I mean, the particular trap he showed me is like top end.
Yeah.
That sells for, I'm not going to give too close of a number so someone doesn't figure this out, but let's say $350 a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of these sold.
Mm-hmm.
I could have bought that trap that I could not physically tell the difference for $3.50 a piece.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I know that would tempt somebody, you know, yeah, to do that. And they pulled out other stuff from friends of mine.
Yeah.
That, you know, one of them, I helped them do this. Right. And I'm like, how did you, what?
Yeah.
And I go, what about patents? And he just went, eh.
Yeah, and they're not worried about it. I mean, you know, you're not going to really get them. You could theoretically, even if you could find the Chinese person that is doing this, you could have their passport flag, but they're not. They don't care. They're just dealing. They can. I mean, we live in a world where you can deal with Skype and everything else. You can have person-to-person contact with anybody in the world at any time with no problem. So
one of the funniest conversations I had with somebody, which was very similar to this, is one trap is made in Taiwan, which is being sold here. China knocked off Taiwan and was going to sell it at such a price. This is a totally different thing. So this has happened to me twice, and I'm like going, there ain't no way I'm spending that money.
No, it is like I said, it is a cost to benefit ratio type of analysis that needs to be done, and in most cases, it's just not worth it. It really is not. It's just not worth it. You understand too, these large businesses that are, you know, spending millions in patent defense, they also have political connections too, and so they can get in touch with immigration and customs, or they can get in touch with port authorities, and they can do things that the common man has a little bit more trouble doing. And so again I know that I'm probably TTing and a lot of folks' whiskey relative to what a patent is and how gleeful they might be to own one, but I'm really just trying to warn people not to get off into something that they are not aware of. You need to kind of know the game that you're playing before you start to play that game, that's certainly the case in the intellectual property world. It can get very complicated and very expensive very fast.
So just we'll close up with this, just so we can, and I'm going to use a very basic trap that everybody knows what it is, a dog-proof trap. Have you seen one of those? Okay, it's a tube. It holds the foot in there when a trigger's fired. So if someone makes one that's round, and you make one that's square, you make one that's triangle, you make one that's oblong, hexagon, you make it a half inch longer, you make the spring one little bend different. You're still not
really doing anything. So the standard that is used by the Patent and Trademark Office on deciding whether to reject some, their most common rejection of a patent is an obviousness rejection. And what that means is that a person that is, you basically ask your question, would a person that is skilled in the arts, so somebody that's familiar with the trapping devices out there, would they look at this and it be something that is obvious, or what should be somewhat obvious to them? You know, changing the shape of a cylinder on a dog-proof trap would be something that is pretty obvious. That's nothing novel about that necessarily. And for that reason, that patent's probably going to get denied, and you're probably not going to be able to push it through. So some people say, well, you know, what if I combined two different traps into one? Well, the patent trademark.
That's a great one to bring up.
Yeah, and so the Patent and Trademark Office, I've seen it before with my own work. Well, they'll say, well, a person, and this is supposed to be a reasonable person standard. It turns out to be whatever the standard that examiner wants to administer to you. That's a whole different topic for a different day. But they would potentially say, well, it would be obvious for a person that is skilled in this art to combine these two things in this fashion. Therefore, the invention itself is obvious, and we're going to reject it on that basis. You can get around those rejections sometimes. Sometimes you can't. And it depends on the examiner that you have. It depends on the skill of the attorney that you've hired. And it depends on the actual kind of nuts and bolts of the invention and what you're up against from a prior art standpoint, or what was out there before that it's being compared to. But you can't just stick a stapler on a water bottle and get a patent on it, because it just doesn't work like that. So,
well, if you got thirsty and you needed a stapler,
that's right. It seems like
never thought of that before.
Exactly.
Well, I appreciate this, and one thing Chip wanted to let you know before we got done is, since you're a lawyer, he's paying the bill.
Good. I'll send all invoices to Chip. I feel certain he'll pay me.
Well, I do appreciate it.
Really. Oh, thank you. This is a lot of fun. If you ever need me back, I'd love to do it again. So, thank you.